It's the Sound of Ideas from 90.3 WCPN Idea Stream. I'm Mike McIntyre. Good morning. Thanks so much for joining us. This morning's show is about journeys. We begin with the journey over more than three centuries of captives from Africa across the Atlantic, almost all of them to the Caribbean and South America. A small fraction of these African slaves arrived in the United States. Just one of the astonishing facts contained in the Atlas of the Transatlantic Slave Trade, a printed embodiment of an exhaustive online database created by David Eltis and David Richardson. David Eltis is the Robert W. Woodruff Professor of History at Emory University and Principal Investigator of the Electronic Slave Trade Database Project. And we welcome him to Studio 4 and the Sound of Ideas this morning. Good morning, David.
Morning.
Very good to see you. I looked at the wrong David because there's two Davids in our studio today. So good morning to you, David, front and center. David Richardson is also here, and you'll know the difference once you hear the two of them speak, I believe. He's director of the Wilberforce Institute for the Study of Slavery and Emancipation and professor of economic history at the University of Hull, England. Thank you for being here, David.
Thank you for having me.
Very good to have you. And it's not all the literary and academic firepower we've got in studio this morning. I mentioned journeys. And during this show, we'll also pick up the journey of black people in the South who, beginning in about 1910, began a northward migration that changed both the North and the South. Joining us is Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. Isabel Wilkerson is the first black woman to win a Pulitzer Prize, which was awarded for feature writing during her newspaper career at the New York Times. She's a professor of journalism and director of narrative nonfiction now at Boston University. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have all three of you in studio. You know, I've heard interviews with each of you, but not with all of you in one place before. So I think this is going to be a different kind of show and an exciting kind of show. The three authors that are with me today are in Cleveland to be honored in the nonfiction category of the Annisfeld Wolf Book Awards, which recognizes books that have made important contributions to our understanding of racism and our appreciation of the rich diversity of human cultures. The awards are a really big deal, and congratulations to all of you for receiving those tonight and in this evening's ceremony. And the books certainly do shed a lot of light on racism and multiculturalism and the understanding of human cultures. And we do have a lot to talk about. We'd love to hear from you. And maybe you have questions as we begin our show discussing about the history of the slave trade. Perhaps you have some insight about that as well. And as we move forward into the Great Migration, we'd love your questions on that, too. The number is 216-578-0903, or you can reach us toll-free. 866-578-0903 is our number toll-free. If you're watching on the Ohio Channel, welcome to you. And you can also send us an email. news@wcpn.org is the address, as always. And Isabel, I want to delve more deeply into the Great Migration, a bit further into our journey on this show. But we're going to start chronologically. And slavery is as old as recorded history, so we'll begin with that. And you're the journalism professor and the New York Times veteran, so feel free to jump in and help ask these questions. I'm sure you'll have plenty as well, as our listeners will. So jump in with any questions that you might have. I'm going to try to lift the book here just with my left hand. It is an exhaustive volume. Atlas of the Transatlantic Slave Trade is an exhaustive volume and certainly took many, many years of work. And I mentioned in the introduction, David Eltis, that what really surprised me was when I saw the statistic, the size of an arrow showed you how many people were traveling across the Atlantic, how many slaves were being brought. And the size of the arrow that came to the United States was a tiny little sliver in comparison to the size that came to Brazil and to other places. Perhaps it's my lack of knowledge or the focus on our history of slavery in America, but I certainly was shocked that it was just 4%. Is it a common misperception?
It is indeed a very common misperception. The explanation of it, I think, lies in the fact that not much sugar was grown in the United States, and the major reason for people being hauled across the Atlantic was, in fact, sugar. And the second reason is that North America is somewhat further away from Africa. And as a consequence, it's somewhat more expensive to carry people over that distance.
Sugar was king.
Sugar was king.
I thought, and again, it's our history perception, cotton was, in my mind, the cause for slavery, the reason for bringing people to the United States, for sure. But sugar far outweighed that.
It did. Cotton was actually king, too, but it was king in the 19th century after the Atlantic slave trade had been officially abolished by the U.S. in 1807. There were some illegal arrivals after that point, but the bulk of slave arrivals overwhelmingly was before 1807, and that was before cotton developed.
And yet the slave population in the United States and North America grew immensely. How do you account for that? The idea that not as many came originally. David Richardson, let's ask you. Not as many came from Africa to populate here, but was it just robust population growth here?
Well, there was obviously the beginnings of population growth among the slave population in what became the United States, even before the American Revolution. You do not find a similar situation in Brazil or in the Caribbean, where slave populations, for the most part, did not sustain themselves through natural reproduction.
Why not? What was different?
There are all sorts of explanations offered by historians of that. To some extent, it's the availability of food. The United States, of course, much bigger land area, more accessible food supplies. There is also a less density of population and therefore less opportunities for infectious diseases to spread. And one also has to take into account the possibility that the cultivation of sugar itself simply drained people, it consumed people. And it's one of the sad facts of the Atlantic slave trade that it grew to an enormous size, in part to feed the sweet tooth of people in Europe and indeed in North America through cultivation of sugar.
Our number is 216-578-0903 if you'd like to get in on this discussion about the fascinating book, Atlas of the Transatlantic Slave Trade. You can also call us at 578-0903 in the 866 prefix. That's the toll-free number, 866-578-0903. It was a sweet tooth, as you mentioned. This was not – was it also, though, a contributor to the progress of the Americas, that what we know as America today would not have been the same had it not been for this this mark in history?
Well, clearly, if you look at the history of the United States, history of Caribbean or Brazil, the areas which had the highest per capita incomes, they tend to be the areas through 1860, 1840, the areas where, in fact, you have heavy concentrations of slave populations. Slaves undoubtedly contributed to the growth of wealth in the Americas. And of course, they contributed to the repeopling of the Americas in a very substantial way. Something like four times as many enslaved Africans crossed the Atlantic before 1820 as white settlers crossed the Atlantic. Hmm. And if you look at the figures on the female populations moving across the Atlantic, the ratio is something like 8-1 in favor of enslaved African women. So the enslaved population played a major part in the repeopling of the Americas, addressing issues of, if you like, labor scarcity, and thereby enriching the American colonies and ultimately the United States itself.
David Altus, what was the idea behind putting together this database online and now this this atlas as well? What is it that you're hoping to accomplish with this and the immense amount of detail that you're providing?
We're hoping in the end to provide, to strengthen, I guess, information on the origins of African peoples in the Americas. And the irony is that, in fact, records are such that we have a better chance of tracking the transatlantic phase of the journey, at least for Africans, than we have for Europeans. And the reason is very simple. Africans were commodities for several centuries, and the records kept were infinitely better than the records kept for free migrants and even indentured servants, who also were a form of property. So the basic point to keep in mind is that the records are superior. What we lack at this point is information on the origins of Africans before they get on board the vessel. But we have a second project underway, which we can talk about a little later, which is an attempt to rectify that. So the ultimate goal, to answer your question directly, is to try and create for people of African origin what has been in existence for many centuries for people from Europe.
What struck me, and you just mentioned the idea of people being treated as commodities.
Yes.
What struck me from looking at the Atlas was the pervasive sense that there was no question about the morality of this. This was mm-hmm. there was no worry about human suffering. This was literally, if there were 300 slaves that died in a ship, the way it was put in a log was, that's $10 a head we just lost. Mm-hmm. Were either of you struck by that as well as you were doing this research about the inhumanity of it all?
Yes, I think in my case, just the disconnect between the values at the time and the values of the 1960s when I first started getting interested in this was what provided a major impulse for the whole project. To see vessels called Liberty carrying, and we have about 60 cases of vessels called Liberty carrying people from Africa to the Americas, and others called the 4th of July, indicates a total disconnect and a total lack of awareness of really what it does is defines the eligibility of slavery. There never was such a thing as a white slave in the sense that we had African slaves. And the shift over time between that situation and the situation that began to appear in the late 18th century is, for me, fascinating and has very important implications for understanding human societies throughout history.
David Richardson, one of the other misperceptions or misconceptions might be that ships went and then there was a rounding up of Africans to enslave and to bring back. And in fact, there was a lot of complicity. There were certainly disagreements and turf battles and cultural battles within Africa that led to these slaves essentially being ready to be put on ship at the shoreline. Tell me a little bit about that. What about the complicity of African people in the African slave trade?
There is no doubt that the internal supply mechanisms of slaves within Africa remained very largely under the control of Africans themselves. And what was clearly important in terms of the sustaining of a traffic at the levels that it reached in the 18th century was the development of commercial infrastructures on the African coast and at certain particular points where, in fact, transactions in slaves could carry on, as you were indicating earlier, Mike, in a purely commercial, commodity-orientated basis, and people were being transacted at the coast as commodities.
So they were further inland, perhaps they would have been captured.
They were captured inland, usually in some form of violence, and then moved to the coast, and there were commercial networks of varying degrees of sophistication and efficiency which delivered people to the coast. And those networks were very largely under the control of Africans. Sometimes they were sustained by inflows of credit in the form of commercial trade goods to exchange for slaves at internal markets.
I'd seen one quote where it was, why would Africans do this to another and to other Africans? And the answer from the original was, I didn't know they were Africans. The idea that it's really very, very parochial. And when you look in the book on the page where you talk about the various different constituencies in that region of Africa, there was a circle almost every inch. There mm-hmm. were so many different competing interests in that region that this type of thing you would think it was a vanquishing effort.
Africans saw themselves primarily in terms of ethnic groupings or allegiances and so on. They did not see themselves in terms of Africans continental-wide or indeed, I guess, in terms of nations as we would see that today.
If I can just add to that, there's no doubt that everyone in history has ancestors who were both slaves and owners of slaves. You just go back far enough and you can find that connection. The interesting question for us is eligibility for enslavement. And what's striking about the transatlantic slave trade is that there was a clear eligibility defined in terms of Africa alone. But if you go back before 1500, Especially in the European case, you can find many cases of white slaves. In fact, the word slave itself comes from Slav, because the major source of slaves for many centuries was, in fact, Eastern Europe.
Oh, really?
And, in fact, Europeans themselves bought and sold slaves between themselves and to the Islamic world into the 12th, 13th, and actually, in some cases in the south, well into the 18th century.
And you pick this up in the 1500s, early 1500s, because that's essentially when ship traffic, there could be robust enough ships, yes, to bring traffic across the Atlantic, hence the transatlantic.
Plus the fact, I think, there's an emerging sense of identity in Europe, which recognizes eventually that Europeans should not be slaves. And I think the same happens in the Islamic world. And basically, Europe and Islam come to a face-off. Standoff, and both turn to Africa as a source of slaves. You will find in this period, it's not just the transatlantic slave trade that's pulling Africans into the Americas. There's also an Islamic slave trade, which is pulling Africans into the Islamic area as well. Hmm. Africa, for several centuries, is defined as the source of slaves.
We're going to take a quick break right here. I'd love to ask you guys a little bit later in the program a little bit more about the Middle Passage and the conditions on board these ships, as you detail much of that through ships' logs and other information both on the website and in the Atlas of the Transatlantic Slave Trade. When we come back out of the break, though, we are going to be speaking with Isabel Wilkerson about her book, The Warmth of Other Suns. It's about the great migration from the south to the north of American blacks. And we will get into that topic right after this break. It's Sound of Ideas. I'm Mike McIntyre.
I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking part of the South to transplant in alien soil to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom.
You're back with The Sound of Ideas on 90.3. I'm Mike McIntyre. Beautiful quote from Richard right there, and it was voiced by Lawrence Caswell, our technical producer. Isabel Wilkerson, that gave you the motivation, the inspiration for the title of your book, The Warmth of Other Suns. Tell me about that. What about that quote kind of informed the job that you tried to do with this?
Well, the quote actually came very late in the process. I worked on this book for 15 years, and I interviewed over 1,200 people.
That's what every reporter says. It was actually a two-month job, right?
Yeah.
And, 15 years.
15 years.
Wow.
I interviewed over 1,200 people to try to recreate the experience of people who were leaving the region of the country where most of the Africans who had been brought to the United States, as we talked in the first half of this of our conversation, where they were based. At the beginning of the 20th century, 90% of all African Americans were based in the South, and they were there because that's where they'd been brought, and they were still essentially living in a caste system, which had in some ways endured even after the end of slavery, after the Civil War. And the name that we is commonly used for that is, of course, Jim Crow. But a lot of times when we think about that, it was way more complicated than merely water fountains and restrooms. It actually was so clearly defined that it was against the law in Birmingham for a black person and a white person merely to play checkers together. Hmm. So when these people began to leave the South at the beginning of World War I, they were in some ways part of seeking political asylum, one might say, within the borders of their own country.
They were
6 refugees.
Million.
They were in some ways defecting this caste system, which had held them in a tight vise, which was in some ways a manifestation of of what had begun during slavery. And they were seeking, it was the first time in some ways in large numbers that people who were part of this lowest caste in this country showed that they had options and were willing to act upon them.
Hmm. So the idea of seeking the warmth of other suns shows me that you're seeking something, you're going towards something. But what you're explaining here is the fleeing of something, the being a refugee, seeking political asylum on one end, but also fleeing oppression on the other. Was it a balance of both for all of these folks who left beginning in 1910?
Well, in some ways, any voluntary migration, we've been speaking about an involuntary migration, which is what brought the ancestors of the these people to these shores. But any voluntary migration is often a referendum on the place that they're leaving, because they know what they're leaving. They do not know for sure what they're going to. And Richard Wright's quote gives an indication that he was taking this great leap of faith, and that's what any migration is. And I often, the way that this migration has been cast in this book is, first of all, through the lives of three people who represent the 6 million. But what these people are is ultimately proxies for what any migrant, any person who leaves the only place that they've ever known for a place that they've never seen in hopes that life might be better would have done, which is in some ways a very American story. I mean, that's how America got populated to begin with.
What guts that had to take. I mean, you can't go back. If you've fled the Jim Crow South and it's not working out for you in Cleveland, for example, if you came from Alabama, which many, many Cleveland black people have come from Alabama, they can trace their roots there. And we'd love to hear from you, by the way. Perhaps you have that story. Perhaps your ancestors, your mom or dad or your grandparents are from there and you want to talk about how the great migration affected your life. Call us. It's 216-578-0903. I invite you to call us at 866-578-0903 as well, or you can send us an email, news@wcpn.org. It did take a lot of fortitude, though, and there really was no alternative but to forge ahead once you made that journey.
Well, there is something about the immigrant spirit or the migrant spirit that makes a person leave a place that they know so well. They have to make a complete break from all that they've known. There's this moment of departure in which they have to say ultimately goodbye to all the people that they've known and make this great leap of faith, which is in some ways what so many immigrant groups have done to get to this country to begin with, which is why I see this as something that shows that we all have so much more in common than we've been led to believe. The northern cities, as we know them, the populations as we see them is primarily because of this great migration, meaning the majority of African Americans that you might ever meet in New York, in Detroit, in Cleveland, in Akron, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, and most of the West Coast are descendants of people who made this great leap of faith to leave the caste system of the South.
David Altus?
Could I just ask why that migration started in the 1920s and not in 1865? Because that's theoretically possible, obviously.
That's a great question. In fact, more people left during the World War II era, I mean, the World War I era, the second decade of the 20th century, mm-hmm. than had the previous five decades after the Civil War, after emancipation. Mm-hmm. And the reason was because World War II created opportunities that had not been there before. Immigration from Europe had been cut off because of World War I. It was the immigrants from Europe who had been fueling the labor force of the foundries and the factories and the steel mills of the North. And when those entities, when those institutions did not have labor because of World War I, they began to look to the cheapest labor in the country, which would have been African Americans in the South. And they began to actively recruit African Americans. I'd say that's one of the things that a lot of people don't realize about how the cities came to be. The African Americans that you might meet in the North and the West, actually that flow of people began because they were invited to the North. And when they were recruited, the people who did the recruiting actually had to go to great lengths to avoid arrest themselves, because the South did not take well to the poaching of their cheap labor. It made it difficult for people to leave.
Many, many of the African Americans in the Cleveland area came in that era to work in the steel mills, and Lorraine as well. And Lorraine also saw an influx of Puerto Rican people for that kind of work. But certainly the industry drove a lot of this, and it was both a magnet, but also, as you mentioned, came out, reached right in, and tried to get them. And what exactly were the measures that folks in the South took? Did they see that there was a problem here? Everybody's leaving. How did they stop that from happening, both preventing the recruitment and also just preventing the movement of people?
Newspaper editorials from that era show that the leading people of the era were completely aware of what was going on. How could they not be? I mean, there's actually a quote in there in which a person's saying that every farmer in Alabama and Mississippi has had to report the loss of their labor. The land was going unplowed in many cases. People left in mid plow just to get out, to get the next train out. And when they got to the train stations, they often found that they were arrested for that.
For what was the charge?
Well, it would be vagrancy because they weren't working, because they were on a train trying to get out.
So really trumped up charges of any sort just to keep the labor intact.
A lot of this, as you can see, has to do with a kind of mutation of the commodification that we're talking about during the slave trade. In other words, a lot of this was economics based. It was about labor and the need for cheap labor to maintain the cotton industry, the tobacco industry, the rice industry, and whatever the sugar industry would have been in the South, citrus industry. I mean, all of these industries were being fueled by the cheap labor which African Americans were providing, even after slavery ended.
Right, so not technically
sharecropping.
Slavery. Right, not technically slavery, but still dirt cheap labor.
Well, they were unable to necessarily leave. I mean, there are examples in which people were actually traded among farmers as sharecroppers. I mean, they were in constant debt, so they could not leave freely. The entire system was stacked against them. Sharecropping was what was the replacement for slavery ultimately after the end of the Civil War. So they were still bound to the land almost as much as they had been before. And under more perilous circumstances, because during slavery, it could be argued that the slave owner had some financial interest in the so-called well-being of their slave. But after slavery was over, these people were free agents who if they lived, it was so be it, and if they didn't, so be it as well. It was during the time of Jim Crow that we're speaking about, when these people were free, that lynching became a major issue that the people faced. A slave owner would not have lynched his own slave, but once they were free, they actually were more in danger of that. At this point, during the era that I'm speaking of, during the beginning of the Great Migration, there was a lynching every 4 days of an African American somewhere in the South. They were leaving an ironclad caste system, which was enforced with the most brutal of violence in order to keep the people there.
You really lay that out, the violence, as well as the idea that in a courtroom there's a black Bible and a white Bible. They hold up the court proceeding until the black Bible shows up for the black witness on the stand. Stuff that you look at today and you're like, you know, wow. You can understand the motivation for departure. But it wasn't always better coming here either. And you bring the word slave forward by talking about slave markets. Women who came on these trips had a very difficult time finding work and essentially offered themselves up for what would be akin to slavery type jobs, these slave markets. Can you explain those?
Yes, one of the problems or one of the challenges that they faced as they arrived is that, first of all, there was often work for the men because of the foundries and the factories, which had lured so many of them. But women who also wanted to be free had a very difficult time making a way for themselves in the North. And so what happened was they would actually go to certain corners in many cities of the North and wait for white housewives to come and choose among them which of them would be working as domestics here in the North. So that meant that they were actually driving down the wages that they might even make, so that they were that they were bidding against one another to get work. It got to be so desperate for some of them that many of them were working for less than they would have made had they even stayed in the South. There was a time period, particularly during the Depression, where things were awfully difficult for people.
We're going to take a call now from Afi in South Euclid. Hi, Afi. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Very good. Good to see you. Oh, Afi Scruggs is joining us now.
Yeah.
She's a frequent caller and has been a contributor on the show as well.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Welcome. I wanted to address the question about why folks didn't leave in 1865. I think one of your members asked.
Yeah, David Altus asked that question.
Yeah, there were migrations in 1865. Around the 1870s, there were the Exoduster migrations. When you saw the beginning of Jim Crow, not in the 1890s necessarily, but the beginnings of Jim Crow and the beginnings of the oppression reappearing. Then you saw folks going to places like Kansas, and that's where you had the all-black towns, in Bogue, Kansas, Nicodemus, Kansas, in Oklahoma. So, you know, I'd offer that there were migrations, you know, not to the extent that you saw coming north, you know, around the 20th century. And I want to point something else out, too. You know, Isabel was just talking about the women. In Cleveland, you have to look at Jane Edna Hunter and the Phyllis Wheatley Society, because that was one of the institutions that was set up to help women who were coming from the South to Cleveland who didn't have adequate places to stay. didn't have, adequate support. And that building is still around. I think, we overlook a lot of the institutions that were set up here locally because of the migration. It left a big imprint on Cleveland.
Thank you so much for the contribution of Fee. And Isabel, that's a really good point, because throughout the book you do talk about how folks helped each other and kept their identity from the South. You talked about in Los Angeles there was a group of people there that were from what community was it? Somewhere in the South, but there was a club for that. So this is common throughout all of these places that folks went.
Well, the caller was getting to the issue of the many institutions and lasting impressions that we're still living with today as a result of this mass movement of so many people. To her first point, yes, there have always been efforts for people to leave. There were people during the Underground Railroad, and Ohio was one of the places. In fact, the Ohio River was the symbolic point of representing freedom for people. There have always been resistance efforts to the enslavement of African Americans and Africans in this country. So, yes, there were always efforts to do that, and I think that's an important point that she makes. When it comes to the effect of the response, once they got here, what did they do? To this day, there are, in many places in the North, manifestations of the Southern roots that the people had. In Chicago, for example, there are multiple Mississippi clubs because it was from Mississippi. Mississippi was one of the great sending states, you might say, of African Americans in Chicago. There are Alabama clubs here. There are places in New York. There are Baptist churches in New York where everybody is from South Carolina. There are Catholic churches in Los Angeles where everybody's from Louisiana. There were three major streams of this great migration. One was up the East Coast from Georgia, the Carolinas, up to Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, and beyond. And then there was the Midwest stream, which is what brings people to Ohio, for example. People were coming from Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Tennessee to get here to Cleveland and the rest of the Midwest. And then also there was a stream out to the West from Louisiana and Texas.
It was interesting, too, how you said you can sort of see yourself in this, whether or not you're somebody who's parents came in the Great Migration. Yours did.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought of, there are also churches in Cleveland where every Irish person is from Mayo, a county in Ireland. They all come from the same county. And so it's the same idea. And there's still some banding together. It's the same idea as of having come from South Carolina and being in the same church.
It's one of the beautiful predictabilities of any migration is that people are taking great risks. But one of the things that they create as a safety net for themselves is that they tend to stick together once they get to wherever they're going. And so they actually create these communities in the new world. And just as you can go to Minnesota and find a lot of people who are from Scandinavia, it's the same that here in Ohio, you have a lot of people who originally have people from Alabama.
And David, I'll just go ahead.
I just add to that in fact, this practice was going on even during the slave trade era. We have less evidence in North America, but certainly in the Caribbean and Brazil, you have fraternities or brotherhoods created around an ethnic identity.
David Richardson, you were going to bring up the same point?
No, I was just going to ask Elizabeth a little bit about her sources and the people that she interviewed, because it seems to me...
Isabel, that, right?
Yeah, because I think it's very important. One of the problems with looking at the slave trade is that whilst we know something about, for example, the gender and broadly about the age structure of the populations that moved, we know relatively little about the people. Isabel's dealing with a mass migration, but she's also got people's memories of that migration that she can draw on. And I'd like to know really what she's going to do with those oral testimonies.
Spoken like a true archivist.
And a much different historical research project that you had than the Davids had.
Well, the goal of the interviews of the 1,200 people, I actually stopped counting after that, was to, and these are people all over the country who were part of the migration, was I was trying to get to as many people as I could before it was too late. I mean, this is a dwindling population, actually. We're talking people who began leaving in World War I, and the migration ended in 1970. So the oldest people that I was speaking to, many, many people who were octogenarians, who were in their 70s and 80s and 90s even, and generally what I found was that there are a lot of misconceptions about the people who were migrating. In some ways, this is a human story. So whatever might happen in any migration in some ways happened here. You often had people who were the most motivated. You had people who were the greatest risk takers within their own families. They were the people who were willing to jump off a cliff into the unknown. And so that makes them kind of different from those who stayed. Not better, but different. And also, that meant that because they didn't have a safety net here. And with any migration, failure is not an option, not for the people who migrate anywhere. That first generation simply does not have that backup. They've got to do well. And also in any migration, they have people back home who are, you know, kind of hoping that they do well and kind of looking to see what happens to them. So what they ended up doing was one of the great misconceptions is the people were, what were they coming here for? They were coming here to work. And the people who migrated often were so motivated that they often had, they actually made more money per person, per capita, than the few African Americans who were already here because they were that motivated. Not because they were being paid well. They actually were being paid less, but they had multiple jobs just like any other migration situation might be.
Wow.
They worked longer. They were also more likely to be married and to remain married than those who were already here. They're actually better educated than they're often given credit for. That did not mean that they were college educated, but they had finished or completed whatever the limited education might have been available to them in the South.
Fascinating stuff. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your phone calls. We've got a call from Khalid that we'll be taking as soon as we come back from the break as well about the slave trade. Phone lines are open about the slave trade or about the Great Migration. Feel free to join us on either of those topics at 216-578-0903 or 866-578-0903. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Mike McIntyre. Back in just a minute. Welcome back to The Sound of Ideas from 90.3 at times 9:46 a.m. Coming up in the next hour, what's all the fuss over the vaccine for human papillomavirus? Diane Rehm and her guests will try to figure it out a little later. And tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, David Molpes is in the host chair for the Regional News Roundup. Today on Around Noon, Dee Perry talks with the winners of the 76th Annual Anisfeld Wolf Fiction Awards. We're with nonfiction this morning, and this afternoon at noon, Dee Perry will talk with the winners in the fiction category, plus Lifetime Achievement winner John Edgar Wideman is with her as well. Right now, we're talking about the nonfiction winners. Isabel Wilkerson documented the great migration of African Americans from the South to the North in her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, and David Eltis and David Richardson, also with us, documented another kind of migration, this one involuntary, in their Atlas of the Transatlantic Slave Trade. Join our conversation at 866-578-0903. Email news at wcpn.org. You can comment on our website or find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. And we're going to go now to Khalid in Cleveland. Thanks so much for waiting.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mike, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for the panel and this topic. My great-grandmother was the wife of a Cherokee man who tribe had also been in an involuntary migration over the Black Mountains in Tennessee. And her name was Sonia. As a result of that marriage in a free state, her husband and his brother became blacksmiths. They were engaged in a conflict with sharecropper sheriffs that were actually criminals themselves that tried to re-enslave them. As a result of that, those men were killed, and that began another involuntary migration of my family. They went from Pulaski, Tennessee, which was also the birthplace of the Klan, to Carthage, eventually Nashville, and into Cleveland, and they became entrepreneurs. So it basically confirms what she's saying also about risk-taking, resistance to enslavement, and further re-enslavement as something that's critical. The other piece that I found out, which was an interesting footnote in talking to one of my relatives in Nashville, that particular aspect of the tribe were known as people who would fall down at certain times of the day, meaning they had some Islamic or Muslim roots to them.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of harkens to some of the written oral historical evidence in books like Prince Among Slaves about Abdulrahman, an African Muslim who was from a very well-to-do family, was enslaved. and another book called The Legacy and the Story of Ibn Said. I just want to offer those two books because they both profile the resistance to enslavement, and eventually Ibn Said was given his freedom because he was mathematically and multi-language, and he could teach the other youth amongst the slave masters.
Khalid, thanks a lot for those suggestions, and certainly talking about the resistance, as Isabel had mentioned, that went on since the very beginning. And in fact, I did want to ask about the Middle Passage, the trip across the Atlantic. There were many revolts. We've seen Amistad, and people have some familiarity with that. But a good number of results, 10%, I think, of these voyages had these types of revolts on them. What did that accomplish, David Eltis?
It accomplished a great deal, despite the fact that we have records of perhaps only 27 or 28 voyages that actually experienced revolt, which made it back to Africa. The rest were failures, ostensibly. Nevertheless, there was an impact in the sense that resistance was expensive for the slave ship owners. They had to, in effect, go to additional cost to add weapons and personnel to control potential revolts. And the impact of this was to raise costs and ultimately to raise prices in the New World. And when prices go up, the number of slaves purchased goes down.
It's a commodity, again, you mentioned it. It's not humanity, it's commodity. But when you mention failure of a revolt, it would be failure in the sense that we think of it, which is you win your freedom and you go back to Africa. In the end, all of it had some success.
It was failure for them. The individuals participating in it clearly failed, but nevertheless, there was a general impact which was beneficial.
Hmm. Let's take a call now from Michael in Talmadge. Hi, Michael.
Well, all right, good morning, panel. Ms. Isabel, it's a pleasure to speak to you.
Good to hear from you.
Go ahead.
I'm back in Ohio. My parents live in the area, and I'm from New Orleans. And all of my friends in Atlanta, and I've noticed it quite a bit in most of the southern cities, Mobile included, I see a lot of license plates from Ohio, from Michigan, from different parts, of the Midwest and the East Coast, because we're experiencing a reverse migration right now. And this has been in the news a fair bit, and I just wanted to, to get y'all's opinion of that, because I think it's entrepreneurship and people, chasing after good business and good work as well.
Isabel?
Well, I like to refer to it as a return migration as opposed to reverse migration, because I don't believe any migration is a going backward. Reverse, when you think about a car, you put it in reverse, it means you're going backward. And I think I have a great respect and awe, actually, for and a sense of gratitude for the fortitude it takes for someone to migrate. Of course, the current migration is different from the original one. I mean, it's a continuation of that original search for other sons, you might say. And the Great Migration, actually, one of the great legacies of the original Great Migration is that the force of 6 million people, 6 million workers leaving the South, had such a tremendous impact North and South. And it actually was a precursor to the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement would have occurred, but it would have occurred later had there not been this Great Migration. The Great Migration put tremendous pressure on the South and also on the North. And what it ended up doing was that the North began paying attention to really the atrocities that were occurring in the South, and began to be more attention to this ongoing resistance that had been like a tree falling with no one to hear it. And ultimately, that migration, the outpouring of people leaving their homeland, helped change that homeland and made it a more welcoming place for people of all backgrounds. Whether there's a great resurgence of people, influx of people who are Latino, there are northern whites who are living in the South who said they would never have lived in the South had it been as it was before. So it ultimately led to the dismantling of the very caste system, formalized caste system that they were fleeing.
We have an email from Jeremy who said, after hearing from Ms. Wilkerson how poorly we have treated our African-American citizens, I am once again ashamed of my country. Reparations and equality for all cannot come soon enough. And that's from Jeremy. Let's take a call now from Deborah in Akron. Deborah, welcome to the program.
Yes, welcome. Thank you. I'm calling because my family, my father, was part of the first migration. He came up from Talladega Springs, Alabama in 1921, and he was about 8 years old, if I remember, and I was lucky enough to get his story about 20 years ago. on cassette, which I know I need to transfer, but just to corroborate the author's work is very commendable. I teach at Kent State University, and I include the migration as part of our historical overview.
Thank you so much for the call, Deborah. What I love is she says Talladega Springs. It's not just Alabama. It's not some amorphous place. These ancestors know specifically, exactly. I'm surprised you didn't say the street address, mm-hmm. where people have come from.
Well, one of the things that I find so amazing about it is just the massive nature of it and the beautiful predictability. I mean, here we are in Cleveland, and there's a specific place in Alabama that an individual here can connect to.
Right.
It's not random. It was not a haphazard unfurling of lost souls, but it was a very orderly transfer in some ways of people making individual decisions. They often didn't view themselves, many of the people I interviewed did not view themselves as being part of a great migration. They viewed themselves as leaving on their own.
That's an interesting point, because there was not some big alarm bell that went to said, hey, it begins today, and there's a leader that they're following. This was individual decisions over decades.
Over decades.
Is very personal decisions.
That ultimately changed the course of the lives of many people, many famous people, and people of all walks of life. I mean, here we are in Ohio, and it means so much to have this award and to have all of us sitting here at this table, because it represents, you know, Ohio represented freedom to so many people who were part of this, who were caught up in the system that was created by the transatlantic slave trade. And ultimately, what these people did was for their children. And some of their children went on to go on and do great things. Those people who came from different parts of Alabama, and I'm thinking of Toni Morrison, who would never have been able to become the Nobel laureate that she became, because in right. Alabama at the time that she would have been growing up, her parents came from Alabama, it was against the law for an African American to go into a library and take out a library book, and she would have needed to get books in order to become a Nobel laureate.
I think if you're standing on the corner in something called the slave market, you're thinking about the next generation.
You're thinking about the next generation.
David Eltis, we have just a few seconds left. Go right ahead.
I just wanted to add that there was a return migration to Africa, especially from Brazil, in the 19th century. I was talking to someone last night who said he'd been to Salvador and it looked just like Africa. This reminded me of going to Porto Novo in Benin in Africa 4 years ago, where someone said, this is just like Brazil. and this is based on people going back after the ending of the slave trade.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you for being with us today. Isabel Wilkerson, thanks so much for being here, and congratulations on your award, the Anisfeld Wolf Book Award for Nonfiction. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And I also want to thank our other two guests, David Richardson and David Eltis, as well, for your honor today, the book award for your book, Atlas of the Transatlantic Slave Trade. Thanks for being here, both of you.
Thank you
very much.
Really been a great time today, and I feel enriched by the conversation, as usual on this show, but even more so this morning. If you'd like to get the last word on today's topic, there are many ways that you can do it. You can leave a comment on our website, wcpn.org/SOI is the address, or call us at 216-916-6397. You can write to us online, news@wcpn.org as well. As we discussed dealing with food waste yesterday, Dan from Kirtland wrote, "When I lived in Portland, Oregon, the regional government provided plastic compost bins for residential use at no charge. It seems like the Solid Waste Agency here should consider doing the same. If they want to encourage composting, why discourage it by charging for the bins, especially in these lean times?" And Glenn from Tremont offered, "One unspoken benefit of composting is that once I realized how much food my family actually throws away, we've been making a concerted effort to purchase and waste less food." Again, to get the last word, write to us online, news@wcpn.org, or call us at 216-916-NEWS. The Sound of Ideas is produced by Paul Cox and Katie Baker this morning with help from Michelle Canoe. Our technical producer is Lawrence Caswell with help from Jack Helbig. Eric Seaver directs our webcast. James O'Malley is the research assistant. Mark Rosenberger is the director of production. Our executive editor is David Mulpes. And a thanks to David C. Barnett for his help this morning as well. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thanks so much for listening.
You're listening to 90.3 WCPN, Cleveland. Idea Stream.